Lecture 9. The Decline of the Classical Civilizations.
We're dealing today with one of the great divides in human history, the fall of the great classical empires. The fall of the Roman Empire has been the subject, obviously, of immense analysis and speculation, even beginning as the empire itself was falling. Needless to say, for those of you who are beginning to get tuned into world history, the fall of one empire, however significant, might not mark the end of a full world history period, but the fact is, the fall of the Roman Empire was joined in approximately the same chronological span by the fall of the Han Dynasty in China, and slightly later, the fall of the Gupta Empire in India. So we'll be looking at a process that actually has, if not global, at least Afro-Eurasian dimensions, involving significant changes, significant deterioration in some of the great structures that had been tossed up by the long classical period. The fall of the great empires obviously should not mask the fact that there had before, during the classical period, been some significant ups and downs. In the Mediterranean, the Greek city-states, Athens, Sparta, had reached an apogee at the end of the 5th century and then went into a period of decline. This was followed, of course, by the Hellenistic period, which itself would then decline about 200 years later. The Roman Republic rose and then declined, followed by the empire, so there were oscillations. The same thing applies to Indian history, with, for example, the fall of the Mauryan Empire, followed by a period of regional emphasis, then followed by the rise of the Guptas. Chinese classical history had been marked by the decline of the Zhou dynasty over a prolonged period. Again, oscillations. But these earlier oscillations all occurred within a framework that seemed to persist or at least revive, so that one can talk about change, but not some sort of systematic major termination to a period. The fall of the great classical empires, the subject today, is really different because we're talking about a significant alteration in political and, in many cases, economic and cultural structures, after which the world that would follow, still very interesting, still very vibrant in many respects, would really be measurably different from the dynamics of the classical period itself. There are, of course, three separate stories. The Han Dynasty was the first to go. It entered a period of greater weakness toward the end of the 2nd century CE, and there were even interruptions in Han rule itself. Economic conditions seemed to deteriorate. There was definitely rising social unrest, which in Chinese history usually signals a period in which landlords are acquiring greater power over the peasantry, increasing their exactions, and the central state, increasingly enfeebled, is unable to control their inroads. That obviously happened with the Han. A series of invasions from Central Asia, from a group that is broadly named the Hun, a series of invasions toppled the empire. That was the coup de grace, and the Han were no more after 220 CE. The story in Rome was a little bit more drawn out. The Roman Empire reached its high point around 180 CE. That was the point at which the empire had its greatest territorial dimensions. After 180, it became impossible for Rome to expand further, and as we discussed previously, when Rome stopped being able to expand, it was almost automatically in some trouble because it lost the means to supply new sources of labor and to reward generals. Decline was, however, gradual. We don't want to overdo it. But over time, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, and then finally in the 5th, on average, the quality of leadership in the empire deteriorated. Individual emperors were more likely to be inept than had been the case before. The army began to intervene more crudely in political affairs, naming emperors according to who would favor one or another factions in the army. Cultural life deteriorated. Original work tended to yield to copying efforts, textbooks. I personally hate to use textbooks as an example of intellectual decline, but the fact is, if you're only generating summaries of established information, you're probably not in a deeply creative period. So cultural decline, with the key exception of the new work being done around Christianity, cultural decline in the literary and philosophical central points of Roman intellectual life was part of the picture. Economic decline was marked. The internal trading network that Rome had carefully established began to deteriorate in favor of more local economic emphases and efforts at self-sufficiency. Many agricultural estates tried to produce whatever they would need locally rather than relying on trade networks. Economic deterioration in this sense obviously also led to a worsening in taxation conditions. The central state found itself unable to collect as much tax revenue as it had been accustomed to, and this was something that would then feed political decline. You have clearly something of a vicious cycle that described a major reduction in the empire's ability to function. This was then followed by a period of increased invasion, particularly pressure from Germanic tribes on the northern border of the empire, pressing in by migration as well as invasion. But in one case, there was also a direct attack of the Huns, another group of Huns from Central Asia, who came into Italy, sacked Rome, and was bought off only by elaborate negotiations by the Roman papacy. Invasion, again, as in the case of the Han dynasty, set the seal to imperial decline in Rome, but the process had been going on for a long time before this final blow. The Roman Empire officially ended, at least in the West, around 476 CE, but again, this was the culmination of decades, even centuries, in which the empire simply had stopped functioning as well as it had done at its high point. The case of India is frankly simpler. The Gupta Empire began to face a deterioration in operations in the 5th century. Emperors found themselves less able to control local rulers, another theme that we see in all three cases. So decentralization, even though there was still an emperor in name, decentralization began to occur. Local officials began to usurp the functions of the central government in terms of regulating local peasants, exacting taxes, etc. And then in the 6th century, CE, another set of invasions from Central Asia, again, another group of Huns, dislodged the empire altogether, and the Gupta Empire was no more. So we have three cases. They are not exactly tidy chronologically. The cases spread from the 3rd century to the 6th century CE, almost 400 years. But given the fact that the classical period had operated in terms of focus mainly on individual cases rather than some sort of coordinated whole, to have such similar developments occur this close together is taken by most world historians as an indication that you really can talk about some common processes and, as we will see, some common results, and use these cases to say, well, by 500, or yield a little bit in terms of the Gupta Empire, at least 600, the classical world is really gone. The coincidence in process, the fact that three magnificent empires found themselves less able to function, the qualities of central leadership deteriorated, local political and economic elements began to see center stage, economic performance stagnated, in some cases at least, increased social unrest would respond to worsening conditions, which could make the situation still worse in turn, and all of this capped by a series of invasions. This process has enough in common not only to mark the end of one of the major world history periods, and as we will see also, the beginning of the next one, but also to stimulate tremendous discussion of what kinds of causes were involved, why these magnificent edifices could crumble as they did. Historians have debated these issues, particularly, frankly, focused on the fall of the Roman Empire. Historians have debated these issues for a very long time, and there are lots of candidates. At one point, there was speculation that somehow changes in climate, changes in basic environment were involved, and people wondered if there had been some sunspots or some other disaster in the wider environment that reduced the quality of harvests and disrupted economic activity. In the case of Rome, there was a long debate at the time, actually, and then it was again revived in the 18th century. There was a long debate as to whether the rise of Christianity was responsible for some sort of weakening of classic Roman virtues. Not necessarily anti-Christian, this argument could hold that Christianity, with its otherworldly, turn-the-other-cheek emphasis, while a vital and important addition to world history, was so different from the kinds of martial virtues that had organized the Roman Empire that this in itself was a cause of deterioration. These factors now are mainly put to the side in favor of three coincident emphases with regard to causation. First, quite obviously, in all three cases, invasion was a key factor. We don't quite know what turmoil in Central Asia, possibly population expansion, possibly internal rivalries, began to propel groups of Huns into patterns of migration and attack on the established empires, first in China, then in Europe and the northern Middle East, then finally in India. We don't quite know what propelled these attacks, but we certainly know they occurred. In the case of China and India, the attacks of the Huns were directly responsible for the fact of the end of empire. In the case of the Roman Empire, the pattern is a little more complicated because the direct invaders of Rome were, for the most part, Germanic tribes who had been hovering on the borders of the empire for some time, some of them partly Romanized, some of them not. But the Germanic tribes themselves were pushed into the empire partly because of invasions from Central Asia, the Huns again. And as I noted, in one instance, the Huns attacked Italy quite directly. Okay, so the first factor involved in all cases was the new pressure of invasion. But we also know, frankly, that these invaders, although fearsome, would not have ended these great empires if the empires had been at the height of their vitality. The Germanic tribes, the largest group to press into classical territory, the Germanic tribes numbered at most a tenth of the population of the Roman Empire itself. There was no particular weapons advantage, no particular military edge for the invaders. The Huns were skillful horsemen, and they had developed stirrups, which allowed them to mount and shoot more effectively than cavalry had done previously. So there were some factors involved. But again, without any question, at the height of the Roman Empire or the height of the Han Dynasty, the military apparatus of the empires would have been amply sufficient to push these invaders back, possibly with some difficulty, but they would have won. All right, so something else is involved. Factor number two. Less familiar, but really crucial in the case of Rome for sure and China almost for sure. Factor two is a new incidence of disease hitting in the Roman case in the 4th and 5th centuries, possibly with some incidents a bit earlier. We don't know quite what these new epidemics were. Possibly this was the first incursion of smallpox outside of southern Asia. May have also involved measles, which can be a deadly disease for a population that had not previously been exposed and developed some inherent resistance. In any event, up to a quarter, possibly even a third, of the population of the Roman Empire was swept away by these disease factors. We know there was also an epidemiological crisis in China. We don't have the figures quite as firmly. But in two of the major cases, new patterns of disease causing massive levels of death clearly caused economic and social dislocation that helps explain why economies began to function less well, why there was more emphasis on economic localization as people worked hard to find available labor and pulled back from some of the more elaborate production and trade arrangements that had marked the empires at their height. Again, this kind of crisis would obviously have political implications because the governments would find it less easy to collect taxes. There would be more pressure from local landlords to compensate for their revenue decline by increasing their pressure on the local population. Disease factors clearly enter into the picture and maybe, although we're less accustomed to these explanations, may be a really big part of the story. The diseases probably spread from India, which as a more tropical area had had higher rates of disease previously and frankly was more accustomed to them. The kinds of trading connections with India that we discussed in the earlier lecture clearly helps explain why disease could now move more readily from one region to another, with devastating effects when these diseases were unfamiliar, as they clearly were in these instances. So, we have two factors that are, to some extent, beyond at least normal human control. The pressure of invasion, which could have been handled, but then when compounded by devastating disease, disease that had economic effects, but probably also psychological effects, reducing the vitality, reducing the confidence of the peoples affected. We have a package that already is quite powerful. But it's obviously important to talk about a third set of causes. And this is the one where greatest attention has often focused, particularly in the Roman case, a package that has something to do with the human qualities, the institutional qualities of the empires involved. Pretty clearly, though it's not always to tell which is the cart and which is the horse, pretty clearly, leadership deterioration was a factor in the decline of the great empires. Emperors, possibly because of inbreeding, possibly because of army interference in the case of Rome, emperors became, on the average, less talented. Once in a while, there'd be an exception like Diocletian or Constantine in Rome, but on the average, leadership quality deteriorated. Perhaps more interestingly, because it's a larger category within which leadership changes can be subsumed, possibly more interesting was an increased selfishness, an increased short-sightedness on the part of elites more generally. Upper-class people began to indulge in an appetite for pleasure, in an interest in short-term material advantage, short-term sensual indulgence. They began to be less willing to serve the state. They began to be less willing to serve in military leadership capacities. It was more important to have fun than to do the tough stuff of maintaining an empire. We see this clearly in the case of Rome. It's highly probable also in the case of Han China and Gupta India. And finally, although again this has been applied particularly to Rome, there may even have been a deterioration in morale of ordinary people. In the case of Rome, one refers to the bread and circuses that the empire had provided ordinary people in Rome, urging them to attend festivals, urging them to take largesse from the state instead of devoting themselves to economic productive activity, devoting themselves to military service, etc. One symptom, certainly of population decline, probably also of changes in morale and social confidence, one symptom was that it became increasingly necessary to recruit foreigners, in the case of Rome, Germanic tribesmen, to serve in military forces because it was simply impossible to find enough ordinary citizens, previous inhabitants of the empire, to perform these duties. This is obviously a powerful causation package, and it has been written more broadly still in some renderings of world history. The fall of the great classical empires, and particularly the fall of Rome, raises almost inevitably the question, is there some inherent law in human history such that a successful civilization will have a period of infancy when it's developing its values and beginning its surge of expansion, a long period, if it is indeed successful, of adulthood in which the mature institutions and ideas are forged, the empire reaches its height of expansion, But then followed, again, law of history, inevitably by old age, in which the empire, the civilization begins to totter, its sources of vitality yield to greater weakness, and finally it fades away altogether. This notion of a human-like pattern of existence for major societies was posited, among other things, by the great British world historian Arnold Toynbee, and it is a very, very tempting picture, i.e., civilizations will reach a height that they simply can't sustain because their bureaucracies will become more venal, more defensive, and less interested in the kind of innovation that created the vitality of the civilization in the first place. Upper classes will turn selfish. Leadership will turn narrower. The whole system, the very success of the system, carries the seeds of its own destruction. And, equally obviously, this notion of laws of history, and particularly laws of history applied to the great classical examples, have tempted some observers in the 20th and 21st centuries to wonder whether these laws and the analogy of the fall of the great classical empires also may apply to societies today. Is the West, for example, on the same road that carried Rome to destruction? Are signs of unwillingness to serve in the military, efforts at tax evasion, clear corruption in the upper classes, are these patterns that will see the West, or possibly particularly the United States, follow the path that had been carved by the great classical empires because not just of the fact of this analogy, but because of the force of the laws of world history? Happily, or at least possibly happily, the laws of history notion in this case need to be modified for the classical period itself by a recognition that the actual fate of the different civilizations varied immensely from one case to another. So far, I have frankly cheated by arguing that we've got one type of decline and fall occurring in slightly different specific respects at slightly different chronological points. I've cheated. There are, in fact, four cases, and it's important to recognize these four and then to talk about why four rather than one. The easiest case, where I cheated particularly, is in the case of the Guptas. The fall of the Gupta Empire in India was a major development. It was followed by a long period, literally centuries, in which no large empires were created in India except as a result of invasion. Muslim invasion, later British invasion. The next time a really overarching Indian state was created by Indians themselves after the fall of the Gupta was frankly in 1947 with the creation of Indian democracy after the departure of the British. That's a long period, and that means that something did change in the Indian pattern after the fall of the Guptas. But India's cultural life continued. Hinduism would change, but it continued to spread, and its changes actually suggested new sources of strength. The Indian social system, the caste system, continued to define life, not changelessly, but the system itself was basically intact, and it too continued to spread territorially, reaching the southernmost parts of the subcontinent after the classical period. India's trade activity worsened perhaps a little bit in ensuing centuries, but India remained a very productive economy, vitally engaged in both internal and world trade. This was a significant change, in other words, but frankly not exactly the decline and fall of a civilization. The Chinese case, another specific, the Chinese case involves a more significant change. Here you're dealing with very real social as well as political dislocation. And the fall of the Han Dynasty was followed by literally 350 years, a very long time in Chinese history, in which central government institutions did not operate. China was divided politically into regional entities. Landlord power increased considerably. Invasions from the outside periodically marked the Chinese structure, so that you're talking not just about political dislocation, but social and economic dislocation as well. But a short-lived dynasty, the Sui dynasty, was reestablished, and with it came a period in which China basically recovered most of the institutions and cultural values that had described it under the Han. The Han were gone. That's ended. And the period of intervening chaos must be remembered. This was not a simple transition from Han Dynasty to the next step. But the fact is that talking about the decline and fall of Chinese civilization clearly also would be misplaced. You're talking about a major, major interruption, but an interruption that did not destroy the capacity to remember what had gone before and, as conditions permitted, to revive this recollection in terms of an active reinstatement of institutions like bureaucracy, Confucianism, etc. More serious disruption by far than India, but not exactly the fall of Chinese civilization. The Roman case is at least twofold as well. The fall of civilization image obviously works most accurately in the case of Western Rome, the European part of Rome. Here, the authority of the state really did dwindle. Localized conditions began to prevail. Economic conditions deteriorated. Trade fell. Cultural levels declined, even with the assistance of support from Christianity. This is a real point at which the level of civilized activity tapers off for a considerable period, and then when it revives, because it ultimately will, it does not revive literally according to Roman dimensions. But in the eastern part of the empire, and the Emperor Constantine had, for purposes of political efficiency, created an Asian capital for the empire to parallel the Roman capital in the west. In the Southeast European and Middle Eastern part of the empire, particularly the northern Middle East, the Roman Empire didn't clearly fall at all. It was replaced by what became known as the Byzantine Empire, which maintained many of the institutions of the empire itself, many of the cultural attributes. Indeed, one of the greatest codifications of Roman law occurred under the Byzantine Empire. So you're dealing with at least two cases in this instance. So, we have a major series of developments. I don't want to detract from that. But it's not exactly a tidy civilization is born, it rises, and then it dies. It may inevitably get disrupted from time to time. That may be a law of history. But you don't know from history, we don't know from classical history, whether the result is going to be a massive change in the capacity of social institutions or a period of dislocation followed by revival. Either path is possible. Either path is illustrated by what happened in the classical period. This leads then to a brief revisiting of the analytical question that preoccupied us before. Now, instead of why decline and fall, why differential decline and fall? Factors include, obviously, invasions might be more or less severe. The pressure of the Germanic tribes on the western part of the empire, in the case of Rome, was markedly greater than the pressure in the east. So one of the reasons the eastern empire fared much better than the west, it had less outside attack to contend with. India was probably less affected than China or Rome because, as we discussed earlier, it was accustomed to the disease patterns and not nearly as adversely affected by some new wave of epidemic. It's also possible, particularly in the Roman West, that despite the glory of Rome compared to India and China, the institutions and values of empire may have been slightly less deep-seated. The emphasis on integration, the emphasis on pulling the empire together in terms of bonds of loyalty may have been somewhat less successful. As we've discussed previously, the Roman Empire was a little bit more decentralized, a little bit more tolerant of local variation. No great cultural system to match Confucianism or Hinduism was tossed up by the empire. Therefore, there may have been less vigorous bonds of attachment between ordinary people and the empire itself. Certainly when the going got bad, as it clearly did in Western Rome, ordinary people frequently abandoned the empire with surprising willingness, often talking about greatly preferring the Germanic invaders to the Romans who had been seen as warlords and taxation agents, whether this was because of the severity of the moment or whether it suggested a longer-term disaffection, hard to say. But it is certainly tempting to speculate that the Roman Empire, at least Western Rome, fared particularly badly, not just because the factors that pressed on it were unusually huge, but because it was somewhat less solid in the first place. At least it's worth some comparative analysis. So what does this all add up to? Obviously, it does not add up to a fully even picture. But despite the variety and despite the importance of recognizing that our image of fall attaches only to one part of one of our classical cases, there were three durable changes that really mark the reason that we use the fall of the great empires to note the end of a period and the beginning of a new one. First, and this is true for China and India as well as Rome, it's least true actually for what became the Byzantine Empire. In much of the civilized world, the formation of empire, the emphasis on empire, now at least for some time diminished. Societies were either less capable of maintaining these large integrated political structures or were less interested in it or both. So while empire does not disappear in the next phase of world history, it's certainly less emphasized. It becomes much less a focal point, which leads to the second general result. The deterioration of this worldly conditions, economic, political decline in the cases particularly of China and Rome, inevitably helped push people to think about cultural alternatives to the kinds of political values that had described the classical period. And not surprisingly, the end of the classical period and the beginning of the next period in world history would be marked by a much greater religious emphasis than had been true of the classical period itself, particularly outside India. And finally, although this is a geographically confined result, the changes in the Roman Empire did mark what seems to be a permanent division of the Mediterranean world, ultimately into three different entities: Western Europe, the Northern Middle East, Southeastern Europe, and the rest of the Mediterranean coast, including North Africa. This division of the Mediterranean, which had always been at least a tentative entity in the classical period under the Greeks, the Hellenistic kingdoms, and certainly the Romans. This division of the Mediterranean would mark the next phase of world history and would continue to mark world history right up to the present day, again, a result of this major period of collapse and transformation.